Joining us today on the Innovative Ideas podcast is Joseph Antos, the William H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. Mr. Antos is also a commissioner of the Maryland Health Services Cost Review Commission, a health advisor to the Congressional Budget Office, and an adjunct professor at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Before joining AEI, Mr. Antos was also Assistant Director for Health and Human Resources at the Congressional Budget Office. Today, Joe and I are going to be talking about health spending disparities across the U.S., research on which was developed by Jack Wenberg at Dartmouth College. We'll also be discussing a recent article by Atul Gawande in The New Yorker on McAllen, Texas, which stood out as one of the nation's most expensive towns and which was mentioned by the president in some of his recent speeches. John will be talking about what the health spending disparities tell us about American healthcare and what we can do to address those disparities. Joe, one of the hottest, so to speak, ideas in the healthcare debate right now is the idea that there's lots of money to be recouped from existing spending programs like Medicare and Medicaid based on research arguing that there's enormous variation in healthcare spending, particularly Medicare spending, that has absolutely nothing to do with improving health outcomes. And some experts, and here I'm thinking of Peter Orszag, now in the Office of Management and Budget, has suggested that as much as 30% of all U.S. healthcare spending may be wasted in the sense that it's not doing anything to improve health. Could you take a moment to explain, for those who don't follow the debate closely or haven't the faintest idea what spending disparity means, what research they're talking about, what does it mean, and how confident are we that it's right?
The 30% figure is a pretty hypothetical number, but certainly everyone who's looked at this, and in fact anyone who's ever had any contact with the health system, knows that there's some waste and inefficiency in the system. The 30% is an attempt to put a number on it, which is, you know, which is always useful. The research comes from, not from Peter Orszag, who gets a lot of credit for this, but in fact Dr. Jack Wenberg, who has been toiling in the vineyards of health policy and healthcare for the last 40 years or so. It basically stems from his analysis looking at Medicare data, which is national data on people over 65, looking at Medicare data and asking the question, why is the average cost of a Medicare patient so much higher in Minneapolis than it is in Miami? And he divides the kinds of services that people get into three categories. Now, before I mention the three categories, let me hasten to add that these are not some sort of objective measurable criteria. These are informed clinical judgments by Dr. Wenberg and his medical team. He has three categories: effective care, which he defines as services whose use is supported by medical theory, clinical evidence. In other words, it works. And essentially, all patients with a specific condition should have whatever that effective care is.
Like if you have a heart attack, you should take beta blockers and aspirin.
Things like that. Then there's something he calls preference-sensitive care, which essentially means if there are two or more treatments that work, patients may choose, or the doctors may choose, the more expensive treatment rather than the less expensive treatment, even though, at least in general terms, it appears that the less expensive treatment is as effective as the more expensive treatment. Now, an issue there immediately is, you know, in general terms, on average, that's the problem for some patients, and of course, your doctor will have a sense, but will not know for certain that you might be one of those patients. You might need, in fact, the more expensive treatment because of something about your genetic makeup or some other characteristic that will make you less responsive to the lower cost treatment. I mean, a great example there is where you have a generic drug and a branded product. Generic drug is, the active ingredient is exactly the same as the branded product. But in fact, there are some people who are allergic to some of the fillers and colorants and so on of a generic product. And there may be slight differences as well in strength or other issues that can actually matter for a patient. And so it's called preference sensitive, but in fact, it may be driven by actual experience that the patient doesn't do as well on the less expensive treatment.
So there's some difference in the patient that the physician is responding to that may not be captured in the data.
That's right. And then the killer category, which Dr. Wendberg refers to as supply-sensitive care, and by that he means services for which, according to him, there is little medical theory or medical evidence that says that you should use this treatment or this diagnostic tool for this particular kind of a patient. Now, there are certainly cases that everybody can think of where, you know, the classic is that you may have injured your foot and you need an X-ray, a CAT scan, or an MRI. An MRI is the most expensive. Maybe you need an MRI, maybe you don't. If there's no MRI equipment available, you probably won't get one. And you'll probably be treated the same way with your hurt foot under, you know, the other imaging methods, because, in fact, in some cases, the images don't really tell you much to guide the physician in terms of how he would treat whatever your condition is. So I think this is the sort of thing that Dr. Wendberg has in mind. These categories are quite subjective, but they do point to, at least notionally, the idea that in a system such as healthcare where knowledge is not perfect and where patients, they're one of the raw materials, and the raw materials are pretty variable these days, that there's a lot of judgment involved with healthcare. According to Dr. Wendberg's analysis, you could save as much as 30% in Medicare by lowering the spending in high-cost areas down to the level of low-cost areas, again, making adjustments for the kinds of Medicare patients that are in these areas and so on. 30%, it's an illustrative number. I'm guessing it's high. I think people throw that number around with it without really understanding what it means.
But people also like to use it because it suggests that we can save a lot of money in the healthcare system today without causing a lot of pain to the patients, really, who would be worried about getting inferior care if we were to simply ration care.
Well, let's stop at the first part of your statement. I agree that it's a popular thing to throw around because it sounds as if through some policy that we haven't mentioned yet, that we can somehow painlessly eliminate the waste and everybody's just fine. In fact, probably better off because some of that care that wasn't, we shouldn't call it care, some of those services that weren't needed might actually harm.
This was actually reflected in a RAND study, I think, from 1980, in effect, coming from a little bit of a different point of view that found that when you put some form of cost sharing in with patients, as I recall correctly, you could save, I think it was, maybe I'm misquoting now, but up to 30%, or maybe it's 50% at the time. Cost sharing could be very high, and yet for most patients, the difference between having a zero deductible plan or even having a, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 deductible plan, they got about the same quality of care even when they were trying to conserve. And that suggested that some care could actually be harming patients.
I don't remember the numbers either, but your story is absolutely correct. That was the RAND Health Insurance Experiment. But here's the point. This is not exactly a new insight, as you say. We knew it in the 80s, and we actually knew it before then. We didn't know a number, but we knew the phenomenon. We talk about it a lot. The only hard part is, how do you do it? How do you eliminate the unnecessary care? How do you get the high-spending areas to adopt a conservative kind of health practice where they only do what is necessary, whatever that means?
Right. And this is a perfect lead-in, thank you very much, to the article, actually, that Atul Gawande wrote recently for The New Yorker about his visit to a small town in Texas, McAllen, Texas, which, drawing on, I think, Wendberg's data at Dartmouth, was one of the most expensive Medicare markets in the country. He used that as a wonderful narrative vehicle for talking about the Dartmouth data. And I think he concluded that, look, it really doesn't make a difference where the money is coming from per se, whether or not it's a private insurer or a public insurer like Medicare. That doesn't necessarily address the spending disparity because, in his view, and I think in Wendberg's view too, there are cultural forces that promote overspending, also supply, as you just alluded to, but also cultural forces that promote overspending by physicians and hospitals, and that we could get to them, or we can only get to them by creating a new kind of healthcare organization called an accountable care organization modeled on hospitals like the Mayo Clinic. And pardon me, you wrote in AEI's Enterprise blog, I think, a very interesting and very nice reply to this proposal. And you said, quote, "The tour through South Texas is depressing. It's not just that they're spending so much of your tax money. It's also that the patients are almost certainly not getting better or regaining a better quality of life for all of that health care, and they may be worse off for all the poking, prodding, and cutting that go on there. If only we could get the doctors in McAllen to behave like their colleagues in Minnesota, people would do at least as well as they do now, but at a much lower cost. The only problem? We don't know how to turn high-utilizing physicians into models of conservative practice. The first impulse is to do no harm, but we also want our doctors to ask whether an intervention will do any good, and whether it's worth the cost in money and personal suffering." End quote. So, Joe, why is it, could you unpack that for a moment and talk about why you think every hospital can't be the Mayo Clinic, every physician group can't be the Mayo Clinic? Is there something that makes Mayo the outlier, or do we need to think differently about spending that focuses on demand and not just supply?
Well, Mayo Clinic is a great example of the kind of healthcare business that is both successful in terms of profit, in terms of reputation in the medical community and with the public, and it's an organization that was not created by the government. It sprang up thanks to the insight and innovation and willingness to risk time and money and effort to create a way of delivering healthcare that was obviously not the norm back in the early 1900s when the Mayo brothers got started, and is certainly not the norm today. So that should be a lesson that the health reformers in Washington take away, that simply because there is a Mayo Clinic or a Geisinger health system or there are a number of other
Kaiser Permanente,
right, many great health institutions that have found a way to organize the way they deliver health care and the way they handle patients and the way they handle their physicians to produce good outcomes at reasonable costs. But there's nothing that says that Congress can pass a law and suddenly the doctors in McAllen, Texas, are going to see the light, and they're somehow going to start practicing better medicine. There are lots of problems here. Of course, it's the organization of the medical practice. That's one big aspect. Mayo, Kaiser, Geisinger, these sorts of places tend to bring together in one business organization all of the services, doctor services, nurses services, a pharmacy, hospitals, and so on. So that as a business practice, there's somebody who's paying attention to the whole. And that makes a lot of sense. If you're in a market where if you do that well, if you manage your business well, you can make money. And if you don't do that well, you'll fail. So that's sort of the background on where these sorts of things came from. And it's a business model, but it is a cultural model in the sense that the doctors have to basically buy on to the Mayo method. Now, there's some selection there. If you go to Mayo Medical School, chances are you're going to think that the way Mayo runs its business is the way healthcare ought to be run. If on the other hand, you went to medical school in New York City, chances are you'll wonder what's wrong with those people. They're not making enough money. They're not doing enough things. They're not exploring for, you know, that extremely rare condition that is only available in certain academic medical centers and on television. Yeah, there is a mindset. And that's something that the government can't simply legislate and turn people around on. However, there are things that Congress can do that will get doctors' attention. One of the most important things we could do would be to enlist the aid of patients. Strange concept in the health sector, but patients actually care what happens to them.
Oddly
and most
enough.
Patients don't want extra treatment if they can get away with it. And most patients really don't want to spend their money or anybody else's money for something that really isn't necessary. So one of the things we can do is we can give patients better information about what's going on. And that's a responsibility not just of the government. The government can help do that. But frankly, it is the responsibility of the medical profession to recognize that those aren't patients. Those are customers. You've got to serve them.
I think you're suggesting some kind of transparency initiative. Do you think that transparency is not a magic bullet for everything, but is there a way of regionally or locally in cities? Because Wenberg also points to enormous variation, even in a single city. Hospitals, you know, in different sections of New York can charge very different prices for the same patient, and we're assuming that basically the same condition there, the patient's not radically different. Could that put some, for lack of a better word, moral pressure on hospitals to try and compete on that level of productivity?
Well, you know, moral and commercial pressure. And I think morality is a great thing, but money drives business enterprises a lot more. And doctors are, of course, healers, but they're businessmen too.
Are you thinking here of something like selective contracting?
Selective contracting. I mean, let's back up a little bit. It is important for, let me go back to calling them patients, for right. patients to have good information about what their treatment alternatives are, and they should talk frankly with their physician on a regular basis about what the alternatives are, what they cost, what the likely outcomes are going to be, what can I expect from this approach versus that approach. I think that's all very important. But what's the first decision that a patient really makes in the health system? And that is where to buy their insurance.
Right.
So the most important thing that needs to happen is we need to have people have good choices of insurance. We need that insurance to be designed in a way that actually, again, pays attention to what the real consumers want. Now, we have a problem in this country. Most people get their insurance through their employer. Their employer is making the decision. For a lot of people, that's okay. But for a lot of people, that's not okay. If you're a kid that just got out of high school and has your first job, or just got out of college and you have your first job, you're at the lowest earning level of your life. You have expenses. You've got that car loan to pay off. You may have an education loan to pay off. You've got Friday night date to take care of, to pay for. You're young, and you're healthy. Do you want health insurance designed to satisfy the needs of a 45-year-old guy with three kids and a wife? The answer is no. It's too expensive. The services are largely irrelevant to you. What you need is something that will take care of the sports injury, the car accident, the things that you don't expect to have happen to you, with maybe a little preventive health services thrown in. The 45-year-old guy is getting insurance from his employer. It's costing, on the average, $13,000 for a family policy. Young couple, no kids, basically healthy, low earners. They can also get that $13,000 policy, but they'd rather spend their money somewhere else. We need to do something about that. People need to be able to make their own decisions on health insurance.
So from the perspective of, from the first order, making people more conscious about the healthcare choices that they're going to make in terms of insurance, I think you're suggesting leveling the tax treatment between the employer market and the individual market. Is that right?
Absolutely. Right now we subsidize people like me. I was once 45, but I'm a relatively high-income person. And health insurance is more important to me than it was when I was 25. I also have much higher income than when I was 25. I get a tremendous tax subsidy that is paid for by everybody who pays taxes because my insurance is expensive and I'm in a high tax bracket. I can afford to pay more out of my own pocket for health care. I can also afford higher taxes. Low-income people, on the other hand, are basically in the opposite situation. We can change all of what's going on here if we make a move to rationalize the subsidies that we give people for health insurance, help low-income people more, and encourage people like me to go to our employers and say, look, I don't want to continue to have to buy a big, bloated health insurance policy that's too expensive. Go out there and find me a better deal.
And over time, do you think that kind of system, more oriented towards individuals and individual choice, would also put insurers more on notice that they need to compete for pricing and then push insurers to contract with, and then you get into a whole other issue of regulation in terms of being able to have selective contracting, but to contract with the hospitals and with the physicians who are the ones who provide the best balance of cost and quality?
Right. When you think about most of the history of health insurance in this country, certainly for most of the last 60 years, since the employers are buying the insurance, they're making the decisions. While they talk a pretty good game about trying to slow down the growth of health costs, they didn't really say much of that for most of the last few decades. That's a recent phenomenon. And they haven't really said, I'm unwilling to pay more. I want a better deal. Why? Well, because when you're in a collective bargaining situation, it's probably a better use of your time and effort, money, to give a little on health insurance than to have a long, protracted negotiation and maybe a strike. That's been the story all along. So what we've basically had is a situation where the real customer of the insurance company, namely the employer, has never really been very serious about getting lower cost health insurance. That's going to change. It's beginning to change now. People are waking up and realizing that it's money out of their pocket.
That's a terrific point. Just to end on, we started out talking about Medicare. Perhaps we should end by talking about Medicare, which everyone refers to as the 800-pound gorilla in the healthcare system. You talked a couple minutes ago about patients being more aware of and more sensitive to issues of price and issues of quality. What changes would you suggest to the Medicare program that could address some of its long-term fiscal woes and help to rein in the healthcare inflation that it's driving in the system?
Medicare actually is the driver. Politicians talk about health reform as if we have to fix the private system and then somehow Medicare will be healed. But in fact, Medicare calls the shots. Medicare is the single biggest payer. Medicare is the payer whose rules are backed by Congress. So what Medicare says goes.
And it's also the insurer that has the sickest, highest cost patients. Is that right?
Well,
in terms of holding, the older population is going to tend to have more chronic diseases.
Yeah, they're going to have more chronic diseases, and you know, obviously, just like in any other industry, you put your efforts into research and development for new services where they're most going to be used. So it's not surprising that much of medical innovation goes towards people who are older or Medicare patients who have these chronic debilitating conditions. Although obviously people under 65 get benefits similarly, but you know, Medicare really is the pivot point for the entire health sector.
Right. And then absolutely in the sense of where you can get the most bang for your buck for designing better ways to control or treat chronic illnesses,
right,
that would be the place where you could have the most effect.
Absolutely. And that's actually a positive thing. But the problem that we have in Medicare is that it is an unlimited entitlement to healthcare providers to do anything and everything, because they are virtually certain to get paid. Now, most people, when they hear the word entitlement, they think it means that the people are entitled, that the beneficiaries are entitled, and of course, seniors are entitled to services under Medicare. But where the money flows is not to the patient's pocket where he can rake off some. No, it really goes directly to the physician, the hospital, and so on. And so what we have is the same situation that we have for the under 65, we have for the over 65.
You've got a third-party payer problem.
People are unaware of cost, and bluntly, people, until, recent years, people have been kind of in awe of doctors and said, yeah, whatever you say, doc. That's changing, thanks to the internet, thanks to aging baby boomers who never did listen to their parents. Well, they're not listening to their doctors either. Sometimes that's bad, but a lot of times that's good, because you're getting questions. We're finally asking our doctors, is this a good idea for me? We need to do that. But we also need to keep that spirit up. When the baby boomers turn 65, we don't need for them to go back into a system where they don't have to worry about it anymore. They don't have to ask any more questions. Somebody else is paying for it. And so if there's any doubt, why don't we do it? And that's a bad attitude. It's fiscally irresponsible, but it's also dangerous to your health.
Well, let's wrap it up on that note. I think you're saying that the baby boomers need to continue to shake things up, perhaps, as they retire. Thank you very much for your time, Joe. We look forward to talking to you again as the healthcare debate evolves.